From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fortune's wheel is spinning around again. The season of rage against corporate America is in full bloom. The first execs are being arrested. Lawmakers are looking to herd in the next suspects, with a corporate crime bill breezing swiftly through Congress as sexy profits and business heroes of the 90s boom are going down in flames. But hold the phone. We're taking a time out from righteous anger tonight to consider what needs saving in America's post-boom backlash. We begin tonight with the latest news from the Zacharias Moussaoui trial. The man accused of being the 20th September 11th hijacker appeared in an Alexandria, Virginia court today and once again confounded the normal path of due process. Earlier, I asked Josh Meyer, Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, about the outcome of today's Moussaoui hearing.
Moussaoui first indicated that he was going to plead guilty to four counts in the indictment, the first four counts, and then he abruptly reversed course and said that he was not going to plead guilty after the judge told him that by doing so, he would be knowingly pleading guilty to knowingly participating in the September 11th attacks.
Where does that leave the case at this point?
Well, as defense lawyer Frank Dunham said afterwards, we're going to trial.
So that means a guilty plea, but going to trial anyway, or the guilty plea is denied?
For all intents and purposes, what happened today was that he didn't do anything. He never entered a guilty plea. The judge was about to accept a guilty plea from him on the four charges, but then she had to go through sort of a legally required set of statements and asking him if he really knew what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And he, Moussaoui, who insisted on representing himself throughout this as his own lawyer, didn't really understand what he was getting himself into. And when she made clear to him that by agreeing to what was stated in the indictment, that he would be agreeing to being a knowing participant in the September 11th attacks, he said, well, wait a second, that's not really what I wanted to plead to, so I'm not going to plead.
What does it appear was going on in Moussaoui's mind? Did he suddenly realize the punishment that he was facing and he quailed in the face of it? Or is this some kind of elaborate dodge?
Well, nobody really knows what's going on in Moussaoui's mind. At some points, he can seem to be a very brilliant guy with a good grasp of legal issues, and then he'll turn around and say something that gives you the impression he has no idea what he's talking about. And it's a very complex case. He was trying to plead guilty so that he could get to the death penalty phase of the case and then try to argue before the 12 jurors to spare his life. I mean, what he said over and over again today was that he believes that he can't get a fair trial in the United States and that what he wanted to do was to be able to at least talk to the jurors and explain it to him. He said at one point, I have to take this course of action to preserve my life. I'm saying that taking account of my condition and treatment that I've received, that I'm making this decision to preserve my life.
Early in the day, which charges was Moussaoui prepared to plead guilty to?
What Moussaoui was agreeing to plead guilty to today were the conspiracy charges to commit acts of terrorism, aircraft piracy, to destroy aircraft, and to use weapons of mass destruction, all of which carry the death penalty.
So he was prepared to plead guilty to those. He has stood up and said that he's loyal to Osama bin Laden. That seems like a pretty full bill that he was prepared to go with.
Right. And he also said that he has knowledge of what happened in the September 11th attacks and who was involved. He also said today, for instance, that he was in Kandahar, Afghanistan, at a terrorist training camp and that he might have even served meals to one of the 19 hijackers and that he also got money from one of the hijackers. But he specifically did say that that does not put him on the plane, in his own words, that he did not know specifically about the efforts to hijack the planes and ram them into the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. And so when the judge heard that, she said, well, I don't think you're really pleading guilty to what you think you're pleading guilty to, and I'm not going to accept a plea from you. And we recessed for 10 minutes. She gave Moussaoui time to think about it. And when he came back, he said essentially that you're right. I am not pleading guilty to those four counts. He said, I'm faithful to Islam, and under the tenets of Islam, you cannot commit suicide. And if I plead guilty to these, I'd knowingly be committing suicide.
Moussaoui has been so reluctant to take legal counsel from anyone offered by the court. He met for 20 minutes today with a law professor from New York University, we're told.
Right.
Do we know what they discussed or why he agreed to meet with this particular advisor?
Well, we don't. We tried to get the lawyer to talk about it, as did the judge, and he won't say what happened in their discussions. The judge actually tried to get him to at least admit that they engaged in some kind of legal discourse, and Professor Reza is his name. Said he couldn't comment on that. But, you know, you have a lot of lawyers who were involved in this process who are just scratching their heads today. I mean, his four defense counsel, defense lawyers, you know, basically have believed all along that they could present good arguments that could certainly save his life because they don't believe the government really can prove that he was a knowing participant in the September 11th attack. But Moussaoui won't let them help him, so.
He's written nearly 100 handwritten motions. What's the theme that he's writing in these?
Well, I mean, he thinks everybody's out to get him. He thinks his own lawyers are trying to kill him, in his own words. He thinks the judge is trying to railroad him, and that that the FBI and other authorities have knowingly followed him for years and therefore knew that he had nothing to do with September 11th, but that also that they're all trying to kill him. So you have a guy on one hand who's thinking everybody's trying to kill him, and then on the other hand, he indicated last week at least that he was going to plead guilty himself. So a lot of people don't think he's making a lot of sense here.
Now he's prepared to represent himself, right, as we understand it, and apparently the trial will go ahead. What does all this pretrial maneuvering mean for the likely eventual outcome?
Well, I don't think it helps him in jury selection. I think that, you know, people in the prospective jury pool are going to be reading the newspaper and watching TV, and they're going to hear these, you know, rantings from this guy. I mean, they're going to probably, I don't know if you're going to be able to find a jury who didn't hear him say death to America and to Jews everywhere. But again, that does not make him a terrorist in the specific context of being a participant in September 11th. So it remains to be seen, you know, what's going to happen here.
Josh Meyer, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Josh Meyer is Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. In Washington today, the House passed by a vote of 423-3 a corporate cleanup bill that the Senate had already approved 97-0. Congress is moving almost without dissent in response to angry Americans whose savings and retirements are shrinking and who, more importantly, may be losing faith in the pro-business Reagan model set down two decades ago. But this is an old cycle. Freedom followed by regulation, adulation, business excess, and then a whipping. Tonight we ask, what's the baby in this bathwater? What needs saving here? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Amity Schles, senior columnist for the Financial Times and author of an upcoming book on the Great Depression. She's joining us from Maine. Good evening, and welcome, Amity Schles.
Good evening.
Good to have you with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Amity.
Hey, Jack.
Hi.
Amity Schles, you recently wrote a column quoting Trollope's The Way We Live Now, and you wrote there, as he did, "Insofar as a man is praised," writes Trollope, "the same amount he's abused." Is that it? Is today's fury with business titans the inevitable comeuppance of that follows a boom in adulation?
Well, you bet. You always have fierce scapegoating after such a boom. It's a routine. We've seen it before. We saw it, of course, in the 80s with Michael Milken. We saw it in the 1930s with a fellow who was involved in a very much similar new industry, a sort of innovative industry in the way telecom has been. That was the electrification industry. Mm-hmm. And the fellow who was scapegoated was named Samuel Insull. He died penniless in Paris after being pursued in the courts. So it's a familiar pattern, and it's extremely vicious when it happens.
Amity Schles, you're going to have to take us further into this, because I have a feeling your center of gravity is not exactly where the media's is and where many Americans are right now on this. Michael Milken is hardly a name that stirs up enormous sympathy, given the kind of send-off that he got. And the people who have already been arrested, executives from Adelphia, are hardly look like great stand-up citizens. Now we hear, just recently CNN is now reporting, that next week federal prosecutors are going to go after and indict top executives, former executives in WorldCom, including former CEO Bernie Ebbers. But these are not names that currently stand for, moral fortitude and all things admirable. So are these really scapegoats?
Well, don't get me wrong. When someone has committed a crime or fraudulently abused his company or shareholders, he should pay for that. The point is that often it happens in an era of intense innovation that at the same time as you have innovation, you have fraud. Why is that? That is because no one knows the potential of the innovation. Say in the 30s, we say electrification, that was a very big deal. And the man who did that, mm-hmm, did some good as well as some bad. You can argue, and I would, that Michael Milken did some good by creating the junk bond, which helped to fuel the high-tech industry. Some of the individuals are rogues. It's wrong to use your company money to build golf courses. That's what we're hearing about Adelphia. Mm-hmm. But it's very typical of these eras of innovation that you'll have both kinds of guys, because rogues and entrepreneurs are not two mutually exclusive categories. There's some overlap.
But what does that suggest, Amity, at the level of policy, and I guess also the level of retribution, because we're deeply involved in both of those right now. We're changing policy, we're looking to reforms, and we're, the government is setting out to send people to jail. Are you suggesting, does that suggest that we should cut slack to the entrepreneurs who go over the line in a period of innovation and change because it's an unknown world?
Well, we should blame them and change the law for the things they did that were illegal. But you have a sense in this era, for example, with Martha Stewart, that people are being blamed because we now feel differently about the era that they symbolized. The 90s turned out to be not so perfect as we thought, so we take down the symbol of the 90s, and she's a very good symbol, a Trollopian symbol, Martha Stewart. She may have done something wrong inside her training, but really it's the eagerness to blame the whole era that comes out. And this is not a partisan thing. President Bush did it. He said the 90s were bad in his mid-July speech. Everyone's doing it. The 90s, though, also gave us a lot of good things. There were genuine increases in productivity realized through computers and through the Internet. Those are not going to go away. Maybe they were exaggerated in some data. Maybe some companies were run by liars. But the underlying achievement of the 90s, that's the baby that you don't want to throw out with the bathwater.
Jack Beatty, do you see the baby headed out the front door here or the back door right along with the slosh of bathwater?
Now, I think that's a pretty lusty-limbed infant, and it will survive this really necessary and pro-business spate of reforms. I think it's wrong to see these as anti-business. I mean, Bob Kuttner has an article in the current American Prospect called Liberalism is Saving Capitalism Again. And it, he, of course, he's referring to the 1930s, when with the establishment of the SEC and other institutions, basically the playing field was made leveler and the stockholder was given a fairer chance to invest his money. And I think the same thing is happening now. We're just essentially dealing with things that were not envisioned at the time of the New Deal, especially with regard to accounting. Indeed, the SEC, the creation of the New Deal really created modern accounting. I was looking at a statistic today that between the 30s and the 70s, the number of accountants went up by 215%. And that was because before the SEC, you didn't even have to have anybody testify, validating your numbers. In fact, here's a piece of testimony from Henry Havermeyer. He was the head of the American Sugar Refining Company in 1899, being questioned by a congressional person named Phillips. You think then that when a corporation is chartered by the state, offers stock to the public, and is one in which the public is interested, that the public has no right to know what its earning power is or to subject them to any inspection, whatever, that the people may not buy stock blindly? Havermeyer, yes, that is my theory. Let the buyer beware. That covers the whole business. You cannot wet nurse people from the time they are born until the time they die. They have got to wade in and get stuck, and that is the way men are educated and cultivated. Well, that was finance before the New Deal.
Well, there's quite an education and quite a wide open field. But Amity Schlaes, I want to just ask you, do you agree, is liberalism now set to save capitalism? Or I had the notion, I think many people did in the 90s, that we were on a new path here, that we were headed out of that old cycle, and we were following Reagan's message right off into a glorious new era.
Well, I don't think this hurts Reagan's message. I would say that, first of all. There were wrong things in the 90s, and there may be overstepping now. We may do things that we regret when we reform now. Reform generally is good, but reform is a violent, primitive thing, especially when you pass it fast. For example, a few weeks ago, I wrote a column about the accounting trade. The accounting trade profession has paid rather a lot for Anderson. There are 28,000 people in Anderson who have lost their company, of whom only a few were culprits in these wrongdoings. And now, through the legislation that's come through this week, we're going to take control of standards and make Washington control that. Will that make people want to be accountants?
And yet nobody's really saying boo about it. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the baby in the business bathwater. Are we riding the rage as low as we rode the bubble high? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255.
800-848-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the baby in the business bathwater, about boom, bust, and holding on to what matters at the heart of American business. Our guest tonight is Amity Schlaes. She's a senior columnist with the Financial Times and author of an upcoming book on the Great Depression from HarperCollins. You can join the conversation as well. Are we in the midst of real reform now, or just a rage? Is this the end of the Reagan era, or just a moment for venting? And if we turn entrepreneurs from heroes into villains, what is the cost of that? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Amity Schlaes, you've written fascinatingly about Anthony Trollope's world, late 19th century, the scandals of that period. Give us a sense of what he was observing then and the parallels you see now.
It's very much similar. There was a new innovation. In that instance, it was the railway. And along comes a trickster and says, I want to build a railway like the successful ones in America, but this one's going to go to Mexico. And it doesn't matter. No computation had been made or possibly could be made as to the probable cost. Nobody knows the potential of this railway, and yet you must join me and finance it. And all of London follows him. And he becomes the prophet of the age. The name of the character is Melmoth. And when it becomes clear that he's doing more of a Ponzi scheme, using money to pay for his house and his daughter to get her married, The whole society turns on him, and he commits suicide, drinks acid, and they all go back virtuous to the farm. Their county squires, they go to the farm and repent of their wrong-headed interest in capitalism, their covetousness, because Trollope did condemn this, although he wrote in a very nuanced way about the way we live now. He did not like the way we live now. And that's so much analogous to our feeling culturally at the moment about the 90s.
But his hero or his protagonist really was a scoundrel in that book.
Melmoth, but it's a little complicated because it is not Melmoth's idea to do this railway. And by the way, this is based on Jay Gould and our own railroad combinations in America. There's even a character in the book called Fisker after Fisk, who was one of Gould's friends. He also shows that there is great value in the possibility of innovation and that the old ways have passed. But in the end, he sides with going back to the countryside.
But you write that in the bonfire of revenge now burns high, but when the smoke clears, we shall probably see much of value in our recent era of innovation. Are you prepared to stand by that, Bernie Ebbers is asked to drink acid?
Well, Bernie Ebbers might have done wrong, and then he deserves what he gets. But certainly, telephones that connect the world are an improvement in the quality of our lives. And having gained that and using satellites and all the new technology that we saw developed in the 90s, a lot of that brought us a lot of good. The Internet is a great good, both economically and in terms of quality of life, and you can't take that away. That's not undone by finding out that certain heads of certain companies were wrong, or that we need accounting reform, or to expense options in a different way, or so on.
Listeners, we're talking tonight with Amity Schlaes, a columnist with the Financial Times, and the subject is the baby in the bathwater of American business. Do we have to allow for greed, even exploitation, to keep the way open for innovation and growth, or not? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to welcome into our conversation now Nancy Kane. She's professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School and author of Brand New, How Entrepreneurs Earned Consumers' Trust from Wedgwood to Dell. Good evening and welcome, Nancy Kane.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you. Nancy Kane, you have spent a lot of time looking at entrepreneurs, at what they do, and no doubt at the environment that creates entrepreneurs and the value and innovation that entrepreneurs bring. Was the 90s a good example of the kind of environment required for entrepreneurs? And are we at risk now of shutting down some important running room in the American economy?
Unquestionably, it was fertile ground for a range of entrepreneurial initiatives and activity and institution building that helped create the term information economy, that helped move the economy forward, both in quantitative terms, GDP growth, growth in per capita income. Let's not forget that in 1990, per capita income in this country, adjusted for inflation, was about $27,000. Now it's about $35,000. That's a 25% increase in a decade. So we have quantitative growth and we have the qualitative expansion and improvement that Amity's talking about. And that existed partly because of established businesses, but also because of a huge range of entrepreneurial imagination and action in big companies and in newer companies.
So what are you thinking now, Nancy Kane, when you see the 1990s raked over the coal, just, you know, scourged every which way?
Well, again, I mean, to respond to what Amity and Jack were saying, this is not the first time this has happened. It's not the first time a decade has been both lionized and then lambasted. The 1890s, the 1920s, the 1980s, and now the 1990s. In each of those decades, there were astounding advances, right? And then at the same time, a backlash against those astounding advances and individuals that were seen to be, as Amity said, symbolic of those times. Think about John Rockefeller in the 1880s. Think about Martha Stewart today. Those events, that lionization and then that lambasting, that love affair followed by a divorce, those events do not change the underlying conditions that nurture entrepreneurship.
But are the waves on top there then just the way of the world? Do we have to have this summer followed by winter? Do we have to repeat this cycle again and again of lauding to the heavens and the excess that comes with that and then the fire and rage?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think in America, it's deeply embedded. It goes all the way back to the very ambivalent relationship that America has always had with financial and industrial business success, all the way back to the founding of the Republic and a queasy relationship that Americans have with too much money and too much centralized authority. And so if America is also historically the best place for the thriving of entrepreneurship, it may also be, by our hardwiring, if you will, as a polity, one of the most complicated places for the people, leaders, government, business, citizens, voters, consumers, to make sense of that entrepreneurial success. It may be with us in the same way that historically this has continued to be the best place to breed successful entrepreneurs in the world.
Just a wild horse to ride. Jack Beatty, Amity Schlaes calls reform a violent and primitive thing. Are you so sure that the reform efforts underway now, and there may be more to come, we don't know, it depends how rough the waters get going forward, are you so sure that they'll bring a better environment than we've had?
Well, I'm not sure. I think so. And I think that the reforms that we've seen in Congress, I don't see how any of them could be impediments to, you know, job creation, maybe in the accounting industry. I don't know. But there, any bad they do is going to be so far outweighed by the good, which is to restore confidence in the financial system, which has been shaken to its foundation. So I don't see this as a danger. And I think there's a Bob Kuttner's thesis, liberalism saving capitalism. Mm-hmm. How I wish that we could have full throttle liberalism, but there are limiting factors today, and one of them is globalization. We've talked about this on this program, and you know it's a competitive world out there, and any untoward fetters on our economy we'll pay for it because foreign competition will scoop us. And then on the second hand, and the Wall Street Journal made this point the other day, many Americans now are owners. Are capitalists.
And feeling the pinch of ownership.
Yeah, it's not such a free shot as it used to be, you know? I mean, you've got to kind of you can't shoot a bullseye at the corporation because you depend on it for your pension.
Corporation are us.
Yeah, so it's really complicated the old in the New Deal, there were two emphases. One was reform and one was recovery. And SEC was reform. But sometimes when FDR would get going in full throttle, he would actually discourage recovery because he would say, I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match.
Oh.
I should like to have it. The crowd exploded. Wait a moment. I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it these forces met their master. And he's talking about business. I mean, he scared business to death. That's an example, I think, of throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
And we have not seen the like of that yet. Amity and Nancy, let me ask you both. What about the kind of backlash that we're in now? Does it mean then in this, I don't know if it's subtle or gross chemistry of innovation, does it mean that we're in for a downtime, a slow time in innovation and maybe therefore growth?
No, I don't think we necessarily are because of the shareholder culture that we've all spoken of. The shareholders have been remarkably steady. I don't think there's an absolute turn against business because, one, they're invested in it, and, two, because perhaps some shareholders expected corruption to occur in business as it always has done. So you look at the American shareholder, and he's actually reacted pretty calmly compared to the way he could have done. And generally, the reforms we're looking at are necessary and good. We all agree on that, even if there's some exceptions that might be a little too violent. Mm-hmm. So generally, actually, the economy's in a pretty good place, and, you know, compared to where it could be. You want to remember, regardless of where American accounting is, it's still more transparent and better than accounting in Europe or Japan.
Amity Schles, Nancy Kane, stand by. We've got a lot of callers who want to join this conversation. I want to start bringing them in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What's the baby here, and what's the bathwater? 1-800-423-TALK. John's calling from Bayfield, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
What's the guy's name that died penniless in Paris?
Samuel Insull.
Yeah, wasn't he the guy that electrified Chicago?
Yes, he was. And that's precisely, as I say, an example of someone who did good, but he also had some holding companies that fell down like a Ponzi house of cards, and he was vilified. In fact, FDR said in a speech, we have to get rid of the Insulls and the Ishmaels.
John, what's your thinking about Samuel Insull?
Well, didn't he empty his bank account paying off people that he'd encouraged to invest? Isn't that how he ended up broke?
That was part of the story, and you know he was acquitted.
He actually paid back.
He was a complicated man, and I think there was a lot of good in him. I don't know that detail.
What do you think, John?
Well, I think that's the difference between him and these guys. And
these guys
be
meaning
lumped in with them because these guys sold high and left the people least able to afford it holding an empty bank.
You're talking about the Enron-style galloping away.
Yeah, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because they made millions, and the people that invested and could least afford it, the people who were counting on it for their retirement, they got nothing. And these guys are sitting pretty. So that makes it a little different than the guy who dies penniless because he emptied his bank account trying to pay off people that he'd encouraged to invest.
Well, we don't know what path of regret all these fellows are going to go on.
Eventually, we'll see what happens there.
People who dislike Michael Milken see him now as philanthropist, who dislike what he did in the 80s. There's a big penitence component to this that goes on and on. So, but those who were real criminals deserve what they get.
We haven't had time to see what exactly may come in the penitence front here. But Nancy Kane, let me put that, what's implicit in John's question, comment, observation there to you. Were the scoundrels of the 90s worse in degree than scoundrels of other ages of risk, reward, innovation, and sometimes ripoff?
I don't think there's any reasons to think so, and this is in no way to legitimate or condone the actions of many of the people that are now being investigated should those charges prove to be true. But again, remember what Twain says, history doesn't repeat itself precisely, but sometimes it does rhyme. Mm. Rockefeller, a range of bankers, including J.P. Morgan in the early 20th century, large numbers of railroad executives, meatpacking executives, and other innovators, and this is not, again, to justify their financial misconduct, were indicted and charged and held up by congressional and other leaders for financial scandals or for financial irregularities, to use today's term. But there's little historical evidence that the degree of their actions or the degree of today's actors' actions was significantly worse or better than another age. I think Amity has it exactly right. In these times of extraordinary change, where even the social contract itself is in transition, the law lags all kinds of innovation. And that means that lots of individuals can take advantage of that gray area. That is perhaps what we're seeing in a large picture view right now. Capitalism itself has some self-regulating mechanisms. For example, I just read in the New York Times this week that a record 721 shareholder resolutions were filed this year. Those are shareholders at annual meetings taking advantage of their opportunity to vote and try and change the system, John, make it more equitable, make it more, give it more integrity. And that is critically important if capitalism and the American financial system are to maintain their integrity and their viability and their effectiveness.
So maybe the law and the shareholders are on their way now. John, thanks for the observation. It's a good one. Keith is on the line. Welcome, Keith. You're on the air. Hello. Kevin. Kevin, hi. Kevin, you're on the air.
Yes. Now, the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union, East Asia, they both went through, they were both lauded for their attempts to have successful forms of capitalism, and East Asia was seen as a success story for quite a bit.
And continues to be in many corners.
Yeah. I was just going to qualify it and say that it hasn't proven a failure, but it has suffered some major setbacks recently in the last few years. And there was a quick turnaround in attributing it to crony capitalism and so forth, and at least discussions in economics and politics and the idea that there's, certain kinds of public good, certain structures, certain things that go beyond, a fundamentalist view of, competition, self-interest, greed is somehow, innate human attributes that if they were just unfettered by, the existence of a public.
So what question comes to mind out of that now, Kevin?
Yeah, my question is it's a fairly simple question, but I think, one of the more fundamental ones, and especially now that, the relations of production and the means of production, this change of technology and they're trying to catch up with it through, be it laws or certain kind of structures of the corporation.
Bring us to the nut of it. Our time is running down.
Oh yeah. Okay. To the nut of it. What's the change that should take place in the relationship between the public and private sphere?
Okay. We'll take it. Nancy Cohen-Kane, do you see a fundamental change required here?
We'll see a range of different kinds of changes, Kevin. I think we'll see changes in accounting standards. We'll see changes in punishments or means of deterrence for perpetrators of corporate and financial misconduct. I think we'll see new calls within business itself by shareholders and business leaders. Remember, there are 3 million corporations in this country, the overwhelming majority of which are clean. They have an interest in keeping clean financial accounts, clean business the norm for all kinds of reasons. So I think we'll see transitions across the board. Will it be a fundamental reconfiguration of the relationship between labor and capital, the relationship between owners of production and those who earn wages? No. The American capitalistic system, I think, is under no fundamental threat here or likely to change in very significant ways. But again, historically that's been the case, that these periods of innovation are followed by periods of broad spread reform that make the system more equitable and therefore more effective and more enduring.
Nancy Cohen, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the baby in the business bathwater tonight. Are we riding the rage as low as we rode the bubble high? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the baby in the business bathwater, about boom, bust, and holding on to what matters at the heart of American business as we head into an era of reform, maybe an era of revenge. Do we have to allow for greed, even exploitation, to keep the way open for innovation and growth in our economy or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Our guests tonight are Amity Schlaes. She's senior columnist with the Financial Times. And Nancy Cohen, professor of business administration at Harvard Business School and author of Brand New, How Entrepreneurs Earned Consumers' Trust from Wedgwood to Dell. Amity Schlaes, I wanted to ask you, we had Paul Krugman on the show this week. He was talking a lot about crony capitalism. He's very critical, as you know, in his New York Times columns of the Bush administration. Jack Beatty brought FDR up earlier as the great crusader against the excesses of an earlier era. does the country require some crusading leader on that scale, of that stripe, to push back after an era of innovation and maybe crossing borders? Or do you think a Republican administration as conservative as the Bush crowd can do it? Can lead it?
I think a Republican administration as conservative as the Bush crowd has more at stake here, because if they don't clean out the stables, then they will discredit the Republican Party. So in an odd sense, they have more to lose, because Republican Party has historically been associated with business. But there's dirt to go around for all the parties on this. I wanted to mention another scandal from 1872 that we didn't talk about, Credit Mobilier, because that was one that Trollope had in mind, and it was about a railroad, and it was also one in which Congress was too lenient, and corporation officers gave congressmen bribes, and among the accused was the vice president, Grant's vice president, Schuyler Colfax. So Nancy's right, what goes around comes around. But no, I don't think the Republicans are any less capable, and as I say, in a way they have more at stake, and that's why you've seen so many writers, including conservative writers, be the first to call for blood.
A lot at stake, but a lot of interest intersecting too. Jack Beatty.
Yeah, just to pick up on what Amity said, and also on Kevin's question about the oscillation of the public purpose and private interest. One of the best pieces of explanation of American politics was written by Arthur Schlesinger's father and then by Arthur Schlesinger Jr. It was called The Rhythms of American Politics. And pretty much he took this, what we've just been talking about, eras of innovation and, if you will, of greed, and then eras of reform. He took those out of the business terms and put them in political terms. And thus you have eras of conservatism like the 20s followed by the periods of liberalism, the politics of public purpose, as he puts it. And the mechanism in these rhythms is generational memory. The people who were young at the time of, say, the 1960s, John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, when they grow to their fullness of maturity, they want to restore the politics of public purpose that they remember from their youth. And so they demand it on the public sphere. Well, this is a big metaphysical postulation. Who knows? But this business about the Republican Party, this is a terribly dangerous moment for them, because if this stuff leaks out of the stock market into the economy, we have a slowdown, we could well have a reinvigorated liberalism. I mean, a Democratic Party to the left of the current party that would be talking about stuff that, in other words, there could be a whole regeneration of liberalism based upon the failure or the perceived failures of both the conservative Democratic administration, so the Grover Cleveland of our time, Bill Clinton, and the conservative Republican administration.
We can't know where we're going here yet. I want to bring Paul in. Paul, you're on the line and on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. I've been sitting here. It really interests me. We have a great thought in this country. We pass laws, and then we don't enforce them.
Well, sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't.
It's very selective.
What are you expecting out of this recent round of law passing?
Well, like, for instance, one of the things that I haven't heard, I understood they were going to set up a special committee or organization that would overlook the enforcement of this law. But, of course, I didn't hear that said. And if it remains with the SEC, it's like we hire a dog catcher to enforce a leash law.
Well, President Bush is pushing $100 million more there. He's talking about his financial SWAT team. Do these not inspire faith in you?
Nothing that gentleman says, and I use that word loosely, inspires me. You know, on one hand, he's talking about this, and on another hand, he's talking about taking the Social Security and putting it into the market.
Paul, let us take your question about enforcement and bring it to our guest, Nancy Kane. What do you think? Just today we saw the House go 423-3 in favor of the new corporate cleanup bill. Do you expect this will be vigorously enforced? It's nice rhetoric, nice words on paper. Will it be enforced?
To be effective, it will have to be enforced. I mean, that's the connection in some sense between the question that you posed to Amity about the importance of a strong president or a strong administrative voice in this. Words are always important. I mean, FDR really did make a difference in 1933 when he said, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself. Keep your money in the bank, not in your mattress." But if he hadn't passed all the banking legislation legislation in not only in 33, but in 34 and 35, including legislation that established the SEC, I'd suggest to you that the banking crisis would have rolled along in, even in the face of his charisma. So a law without perceived enforcement, without real teeth to it, will not satisfy shareholders, will not satisfy voters, will not stem some of the forces acting against the market right now unless it is enforced, unless it can be a real deterrent. So it's not enough to talk tough. You also have to act, and passing laws is part of that. It's a necessary condition, but it's not sufficient.
And Nancy Kane, do you think that in this new period we're headed into, that entrepreneurship can flame as bright, that we can have as much innovation and all that comes with that?
I'm very confident of it. In fact, what I'm seeing right now as someone who teaches entrepreneurship at Harvard Business School and talks to entrepreneurs from all walks of life is that this is a very fertile time for a new business, for viable commercial imagination.
So regulation doesn't scare people away. It doesn't depend on quite that sense of wide open opportunity unfettered.
No, it doesn't. No, it does not, because, I mean, again, a range of other things go into, I think, feeding or fueling entrepreneurship, including the sense that one can claim one's rewards from hard effort and successful business models, including a range of new technologies and new innovation. And remember, we're only in Chapter 3 of the Information Revolution. It's at least a 7-chapter story, and a whole lot of people have come out of the woodwork now with the knowledge of what doesn't work in the first 2 or 3 chapters and will now use that knowledge to build on the technological possibilities of these early chapters and write much more successful 4th, 5th, and 6th chapters. We're really just at the beginning here of an extraordinary wave of entrepreneurship.
And Nancy Kane, great to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Nancy Kane is professor of business administration at Harvard Business School. She's author of Brand New, How Entrepreneurs Earned Consumers' Trust from Wedgwood to Dell. Amity Schles, just 10 seconds. Where are you on the optimism, pessimism scale right now?
I'm quite optimistic because this clearing mechanism, that it happened so fast, is very important. You want to look at other economies. Japan, for example, that doesn't have such a mechanism, they're the ones that end up going into recession, depression over a decade.
10 years and still dragging. Amity Schles, thanks so much for joining us tonight from vacation in Maine, I guess. Amity Schles is a senior columnist with the Financial Times and author of an upcoming book on the Great Depression for HarperCollins. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us.
Okay, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, uncovering the massacre at Mazar-e-Sharif. This is On Point. John Walker Lind was only one of thousands of Taliban prisoners captured last fall in Afghanistan at the Battle of Mazar-e-Sharif. Some of the captured went to prison, others disappeared. Filmmaker Jamie Duran went after the story. His chilling film, Massacre at Mazar, was recently shown in pre-release to the European Parliament, prompting calls for a formal investigation into what happened to thousands of missing prisoners. In this radio diary, Jamie Duran shares what he found.
The major points behind this film are specifically that between 1,500 and 3,000 Taliban prisoners who surrendered at Kunduz are now lying in a mass grave just outside Shebahan prison. It was at this prison that the Americans actually established, American personnel established a force for interrogation of prisoners prior to Guantanamo. Specifically, one of my eyewitnesses states that an American officer redirected the containers out to the desert. And, international law, indeed U.S. law, it's all about chain of command. And it's a question of who was in charge. If it is found that U.S. personnel were indeed in charge at Shebahan, then the, frankly, major allegations of crime that have to be answered by the individuals concerned and indeed by the Pentagon. Basically what happened was that I've been to Afghanistan 3 times now, and on the second occasion I heard stories from 2 different groups, and if you understand Afghanistan, if you speak to different ethnic groups, they don't exactly go out to lunch together. And I heard in separate times about allegations from them about the breaking of necks of prisoners at Shebahan prison in northern Afghanistan. And I employ a full-time journalist over there. I got him working on this. And it was then that we discovered that, in fact, there was a far, far bigger story, which, frankly, the entire press had missed. Such was the obsession with the fighting at Kalijangi and the involvement of John Walker Lind, that the entire kind of Western media had failed to notice that another force entirely had, if you like, witnessed even greater atrocities. November 21, there was the surrender of the Taliban at Kunduz. I spoke to, and indeed in my film, the man who actually negotiated the surrender, Amir Jan, says, I counted them one by one. There were 8,000. Now only 3,015 are left. Where are the rest? What had actually happened was that 470 or 480 had gone to Kalijangi, including John Walker Lind. What no one seemed to ask is, where did the others go? And what we discovered was, in fact, that the vast majority of them had been ferried through another fort entirely called Kalaizaini. They'd been made to sit in their thousands in the fields within the fort walls. Something like 25 containers were brought in, and these prisoners were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the back of containers. Those containers were then sealed. When they cried out for air, the answer came very swiftly. Northern Alliance soldiers fired bullets, machine gun bullets, into the containers, killing many of the prisoners. Those containers were not emptied on the spot. Instead, they were actually then driven on a fairly horrendous journey to Shebahan prison. And we have, amongst our witnesses, we have six key eyewitnesses. And at different times, they give us corroborative evidence. But in particular, when the containers arrived at Shebahan prison, one of our eyewitnesses talks of an American officer, on seeing the carnage, basically telling them to get those containers away from the town before satellite pictures could be taken. It was at that point that the dead and indeed many wounded and many who were simply unconscious were then taken into the desert of Dasht-e Laili, where those who were still alive were summarily executed. My eyewitnesses have absolutely nothing to gain from taking part in this film. They received no money. In fact, the very opposite is the case. They are the walking dead themselves. We had two ordinary soldiers and one general, obviously, Northern Alliance. We had a taxi driver who happened to call in at a, if you like, a makeshift gas station near Shebahan. When he smelled something horrific, he asked the attendant, well, you know, where on earth that smell was coming from, and he said, look behind you. And he turned around to see blood pouring from the containers. And then, crucially, we have two drivers who were forced to operate almost on a relay, bringing the dead and wounded and injured out to the desert where they witnessed themselves, survivors being machine gunned and obviously executed. But one of those drivers talked specifically of, on at least one occasion, 30 to 40 American soldiers being present as the executions took place. There is no suggestion at all from my own eyewitnesses that American soldiers either were present at Kalaizaini when the bullets were fired into the containers or actually executed any of the Taliban prisoners at Dasht-e Laili Desert. But you could hardly ask for greater credence than the fact that one of my witnesses actually admits to murdering prisoners himself. I have just heard that the UN has, if you like, unofficially paid another visit there. Also, my own journalist paid another visit, and I'm pleased to say the evidence is still there for the moment, but it's very much in the interest of certain parties to get rid of that evidence, and it's essential that the official bodies make every effort to try and protect that evidence.
Jamie Doran is a documentary filmmaker. He spoke with us from Windsor, England. His film, Massacre at Mazar, will be publicly released in October. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're